Hey everybody, thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two amazing sponsors this week. One is Environments for Humans. Their latest upcoming online conference is called the CSS Summit, literally csssummit.com. And the Cotton Bureau. Bureau is a hard word to spell. It is B-U-R-E-A-U. Maybe it's only me. That doesn't sound so hard when I actually spelled it. But it's a really cool t-shirt selling service, which we'll tell you about. And the conference I just told you about a little later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off.
Welcome to another live episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about sound effects and front-end web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hi, everybody. Just a fabulous Chris, Thursday here. Yes, Dave?
Chris, you get the Coast to Coast Award for travel this past couple weeks.
Indeed, thank you. I'm moving from California. I was out there in Palo Alto to my... back to my home state of Wisconsin. And everybody's like, why would you do that? It's freezing cold there. And I'm like, I don't have to have reasons for things that I do.
You're not my boss. So Chris, who's our special
also
guest
today? in the cold north is Pam Selly. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. It's not that cold.
Isn't it? Not really. It is
no,
here today.
Not as cold as Wisconsin, I bet.
Oh, okay. Cool, but Philly, and you're like hardcore Philly, right? You work for Axis Philly, you teach girl development in Philly, and just Philly through and through, yeah?
Yeah, not actually from there, but I am an enthusiastic supporter. I've been here right about on. 2 years.
Are you a fanatic? Is that?
Oh, yeah. I actually have never been to a Phillies game. But hopefully that'll change this year. But
okay, but you might want to stop admitting that in public.
Yeah, I think if you admit that, you get beat up.
No, that's only if you're riding the Broad Street line.
Okay.
Got it. Cool. So what about the day job, Axis Philly? What's that all about?
Sure. So I joined Axis Philly a couple months ago, actually a week after the website launched, axisphilly.org. And Axis Philly is a nonprofit investigative newsroom. So what we do is we tell stories about Philadelphia, and I'm on what we call the news applications team, which is basically in journalism, basically the software developers who write news applications to support stories, do data analysis, and cool stuff like that.
Wow.
So just in Philadelphia, just investigative news, really cool stuff.
There's no ads on this thing. Go to axisphilly.com. There's not one. Have you ever seen a news site like that? This is the first one I've ever seen. So nonprofit, sure. But that doesn't mean that you don't have any costs.
We're funded by a grant from the William Penn Foundation right now. So when we're seeking our nonprofit status. Again, it only launched back in February, so yeah. we're still figuring it out as we go along.
That's awesome. It's a beautiful site. Okay, so Girl Develop It in Philly. I'm kind of going through your Twitter bio one by one here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure most people listening are probably hopefully familiar with Girl Develop It. It's an international organization that seeks to kind of help close the gap in getting more women into software development by providing low-cost classes. So I generally teach JavaScript, and I've also taught WordPress in the past, and I also teach through a couple other outlets to teach Ruby or Python.
Yeah, that's awesome.
What's your day-to-day language? I mean, I know a lot of news organizations. We have, like, the Texas Tribune down here in Austin. They do a lot of Python for their data and all that. Do you have, like, a favorite language you use?
Yeah, on coding, we generally like Python. A lot of newsrooms like Python. Django is actually developed in a newsroom, so That's part of it. We have mad love for Python, and it's just, it's so great for cranking through data. But we also, I mean, we have at Axifilly, we have applications in Ruby. We have some stuff in Node. It's a lot of fun just because since it's, you know, every story has different needs that we kind of can use, you know, we use the right tool for the job rather than just always trying to use a hammer, you know, that kind of thing. So it's a lot of fun because that's one of the things that attracted me to there is being able to, I really like doing polyglot things. So that's, so yes, mostly Python, but generally whatever.
Whatever it takes. Yeah. Cause you kind of just, I'm speaking like for my friends who are like in the newsroom. It's basically like a story breaks or something. You need to get a visualization out and you kind of need to be a polyglot or a generalist just to make it the deadline. Cause you need to do the JavaScript in 2 hours and the backend in an hour and a half and stuff like that. Right.
Yeah.
Pretty high pace for you.
Well, that's not actually so much for us because we're doing investigative stories. Okay. So we actually get to do, there's some stuff where we might do a little bit of reactive, like if the city's going to release a data set or something. But generally, and this is what I think is kind of a perk of it, is that we get some time to really get some good data sources and really tell, the idea is to tell like more of the story of not just, oh, something big and terrible happened, but, oh, these big and terrible things happen. What sort of the cause or what kind of urban issues are we seeing that contribute to those big, terrible things? And okay, cool. So that's kind of, so yeah, a lot of news, that's what makes us different than other newsrooms is they do kind of have that deadline pressure, whereas we get to kind of, we build our context before we release anything.
Very cool.
I would like that, I know.
I'm looking at your tools and data on Axis Philly and it's .org, and you've got like crime stats and changes and, that's cool.
Yeah, thank you.
Very good work.
Well, Pam's site is thewebivore.com. I'm sure you can find out all you'd want to know ever at that. We met in Hawaii. All three of us were there, and you were speaking at the CSS DevConf.
Yeah.
Yeah, which was great fun. You talked about, like, best practices CSS stuff, right? Cool. So you're just, that's why I was so happy to get you on the show, because your technology is, what you know is so broad. Which is perfect for answering questions about the web.
Great.
Perfect Shop Talk show guest, because we get some random stuff. Like, do you know how to fix a 2010 GMC Sonoma? Because that's a question.
Is that a car?
it's a pickup truck.
we get some leftover car talk questions on this show.
Oh, nice.
Pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Not on the level of, I heard the HTML5 doctor gets some pretty scary ones.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. Yikes. Because you can't, I can in good faith just email back and say, hey, we don't fix cars, or maybe just not reply at all, hashtag jerk. But if you're if somebody emails you and they're like, there's a thing on my thing, you kind of got to be like, dude, you should go to
a
real
doctor.
Thinking,
I was like, there's going to be some doctor jokes coming up real soon.
Yeah.
So, but also, you know, this weekend, Pam, we mentioned a few things just quick before the show, a civic hacking video that you were involved in.
Yeah, sure. So it's the Sunlight Foundation actually came and visited Philadelphia because if anyone hasn't visited Philadelphia, it's pretty amazing. As an unofficial ambassador of Philadelphia who's lived here about 2 years. The interesting about Philadelphia is so if you aren't familiar with Sunlight Foundation, their game is basically open data, government transparency, how we can facilitate government transparency, follow the money, lots of really interesting stuff. And so what we have in Philly, we have like a civic hacker community. So we have, Philly's a 2-time Code for America city. So not this year, but the previous 2 years, because after that they were like, oh, we should probably let other cities have that spot. So we have a lot of people working on public issues just like for free. So civic hackery. And that's actually where Casey is one of my coworkers at Axis Philly, and I came from that world into the newsroom because we'd work on some public interest projects. Like Casey, a lot of those projects you'll see on Tools and Data are some of the things that Casey worked on Teams before he ended up at Axis Philly. And so it's like, so he gets to adopt those open source projects and actually gets to work on them in his day job, which is always a good thing for an open source project.
Yeah.
And so the video just kind of, it's not just Philly, but it talks about civic hacking and what civic hacking is. And it's a pretty cool video. It was really nice when they came up to Philly and they went to the Code for America Brigade hack meeting and all that kind of fun stuff. So
yeah, so perfect.
Pretty cool.
How would you recommend somebody like gets involved in civic hacking like today? They decide I have X amount of free time. I want to hack my government, my local government. What could they do?
Well, it depends on where they are. So if they're in a big urban area, say like New York or Philly or DC or out in California, out in like Oakland, San Francisco, they each have their own kind of separate thing. And so there's Code for America Brigade is a good place to start if you want to do stuff in person. And they generally, if they don't have regular meetups, you should get involved and help them have regular meetups. I'm also a big proponent of hackathons, which are, you know, a set period of time where people get together and build something, you know, anything. So it can be, you know, it doesn't have to actually work. I've seen hackathons where people present a PowerPoint at the end because they couldn't get their application to work. And that's totally fine. But it's an interesting way to meet a lot of people all at once, even if what you build doesn't, you know, go to production or isn't maintained for a long time afterward. You might build something cool and then say, well, that was cool, but here's something that's way more interesting that we can do. And then you form teams. And so in Philly, we see like some teams are kind of repeaters where a couple people like to work together. And so they'll plan to go to a hack together and get on a team and that kind of thing. And a lot of times they will have met at hackathons before. So hackathons are big, meetups are big, but if you don't have people doing in-person stuff in your area, if you are have your broadband in your farmhouse, I think for civic hacking, one of my favorite mailing lists is the Sunlight Labs mailing list. And there's people on there all the time. And actually, sometimes there's gigs on there where someone's like, hey, I want to hire someone. I don't know if you guys got to see the Tax Evaders game that got released around Tax Day. But I saw that proposal on Sunlight Labs some weeks before. So it was like, hey, I want someone to build, you know, a Space Invaders knockoff that makes fun of corporations who don't pay their taxes. And so if you're on that list, you see that opportunity and then you get to collaborate with people in order to make cool stuff like that happen. So I like in-person stuff, but I know there's plenty of people in open data and civic hacking who are just completely online, just get interested in it and just go for it.
I will be playing Tax Evaders all afternoon. This is relevant to my interests.
Yes, a little bit addictive.
We have a question coming up specifically about hackathons, so that we'll get a chance to talk about that more in a minute.
Oh, cool.
Cool. I have no drama. Do you have anything, Dave? Or should we just skip right into questions?
No, the only drama I could point to is a recruiter decided to email my place of employment. They filled out the Paravel contact form.
For you?
Yeah, for me. Hmm. I'd like to offer Dave a job. That was pretty professional. I was joking the other day, we should start a segment called The Beef with Uncle Dave, where I just complain about something for about 5 minutes.
No, it's called The Beef. Reagan has to do a logo for that.
Yeah, so The Beef with Uncle Dave this week is recruiters. And what kind of alternate reality do they live in? And how do you get to that alternate reality? And I know we have an alternate reality where we congratulate each other. We're like, yay, good dribble, man. You're really important, you know, but like, what on earth do these people do for a living? It's bizarre.
It's tough. I have a little bit of sympathy because at some scale of having a big shop, you need to have somebody whose job it is to hire people because the other people are like builders and makers. And so they can't, you know, they just don't have time to be searching to find people. And then having a recruiter like learn everything there is to know about Paravel Inc. first is like, they can't do that. They have to cast a bit of a wider net than that. So it just sucks because those emails are just ridiculous and borderline rude.
Oh, it just embarrasses themselves.
Yeah.
You're like, bless your heart.
I kind of get
it. You're just emailing people.
No. Well, I think it's like, I mean, like, Chris, you were, I mean, I don't think it's ever people in-house. Like, I don't think anyone would be able to keep their job as an in-house recruiter if they started giving their company a reputation of being those kind of people.
Yeah.
I think it's generally the agencies who are, you know, they're like, you have to make like 200 contacts in 2 weeks or something. And so at some point, like, I've been getting those through my contact form on my website, not as much as I probably could. So that's good. But yeah, it's just like, I think it's, you know, they have a hard time too. You know, they got the pressure, they burn out. But I don't know. It still doesn't make them not look very, very silly.
They're totally disconnected from reality. Yeah. They wear rayon shirts, whatever.
All right. Okay.
And that's the beef with Uncle Dave.
The beef. Can you do a Fig Nuts or something?
Yeah, I'll cue that up. Let me do that. Fig Nuts! All right.
That's our best one. All right, let's get in the Q&A. Dave, could you say this name for me?
Yeah, Gabe Luthi, I think.
Yep, I'd like the opinions on the use of hover, particularly for activating drop-down menus. It is so common to see hover-activated drop-down menus in web design and development project. It has become almost a foregone conclusion that there will almost always be at least one in the main navigation. And this goes on. I kind of just cut it short here because it's kind of like we've talked about hover before, but let's talk about it in the context of something simple, like just a one level drop down menu. What is up with that? Should we be avoiding that these days, or how can we deal with drop downs?
Drop down hover. It's one of those things is, I think actually when the question, it makes a good point. And I think I read an article some time ago about iOS heuristics, like the people who design, or actually it's like one person who, do you know this guy's name? He like designed like a lot of the standard ways you interact on iOS in applications. Mm, he just came up with them and was like, this would be a good user interface. And then everyone was like, oh my God, that's a great user interface. And then every app uses, like slider buttons and everything.
I see.
And it's kind of like, I tended to say that the drop-down menu it's like turning to a heuristic where it's kind of people see it and they already understand because they've seen that pattern before. And so I think it's good, but at the same time, I mean, it's almost like as drop-downs in general, and this is what I would be curious about asking someone about, is in terms of when we talk about the fancier we get the web, the more we actually have to kind of step back and be, well, is that kind of web accessible? And that's what I don't know the answer to that I'd be interested in terms of like hover and drop-downs. I like them, and I have seen them be tricky and annoying when you have just because since it's a hover that you have, you know, the activate area and things, and then you get that on mobile, and yeah, it can get really tricky. And so if you just solve it by being like, well, click on it. But I don't know, because I definitely had times where I've hovered over something and been like, why isn't it showing me things? And I have to click. So actually,
yeah, it's weird, right? There isn't really a standard on the web, whether it's hover or click.
Yeah, it's not. And I remember actually Amazon changed this a few months ago, and I still will, like, you go to Amazon and you're on your name, your My Account, that used to be a click to open menu, and they changed it some months ago to be a hover. And so, but if you click, it doesn't open the menu, it takes you to another page. So that's what was really, when they changed the behavior, because I got used to a certain pattern, and they changed it in such a way that it threw off my buying things on Amazon workflow, which, like, pretty sure Amazon does not want to mess up.
No, they don't. No.
So
trying to buy stuff, yo.
Yeah.
I wonder if this will shake out over time or not, or if in 5 years from now it'll be like, okay, this is how drop-down menus are done, or are we still going to be poking around at it?
Well, I mean, I think like in like 5 or 10 years, like what I'm starting to think about is like stuff about like how, like, are we going to keep interacting on the web with monitors and keyboards? Like the whole Google Glass deal, I totally buy into the hype. I'm like, where are my wearable sensors? like, I'm totally bought in.
You got a jacket not monetarily, that tells you the weather.
Not monetarily yet, but yeah, like the whole, like, this is what we've been talking about in science fiction since, I don't know, forever, about like being able to be like, computer, you know, like bring me the internet. Totally. Whatever.
Star I'm Trek first in line too. If you can put like a chip in my finger that identifies me or whatever, and so I never have to type a password again, I'll be like, get the scalpel.
Right. Yeah, password. That's one password should do that as a joke one year, so that they could really say that one password is now a chip.
We'll call it one finger.
Yeah.
So the technology that Gabe is getting at here probably is that there isn't hover on mobile, and there's, you know,
there's touch.
So,
yeah, that we have different interactions now. And I mean, mobile is just like the first step to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you, here's one thing that you should know, Gabe, is if you add a hover to something in CSS and it doesn't have an href, like a, whatever, like lihover, you know, like a list item, and you tap that, a lihover, if you tap that, it will activate the hover and it won't go anywhere. So that's kind of good to know that, like, you don't have to JavaScript that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the approach I took on CodePen. If you're like up in the upper right where you have your, there's a little drop downy thing. I decided to make it hover because I kind of like hover. But if you click it on, if you're on a touch only device, it will still open up fine, and there's no JavaScript involved at all. So, you know, I don't mind. I also just went and poked at Facebook and Twitter to see what, because they both of them use drop downs a bit, and they're all click, all over. Every drop-down needs a click. So they just chose that as the little, you know, paradigm or whatever. You, I don't know if I misused that word or not, but you know what I mean. They're standardized on click.
I like click. I'm a clickster.
You like click?
Yeah. I just, you think about, like, your operating system. Like, nothing really opens up on hover. That's a web sort of thing, you know? Like, that you'd just be somewhere and it'd just be like,
if I had to guess, I'd say there's going to be more and more, you know, press to activate stuff.
Yeah. I think with touch and hover and all that, like, click's the safer bet just because you don't know. And, you know, and then, like, not to beat the accessibility drum, but you got to, like, focus is a thing because people navigate with keyboards and you got to think about, does this open with a space bar, or, you know, stuff like that. Hey, well, me being
you
a
could convince me. It would be easy to convince otherwise.
But anyway, I think click is the way just for now until hover stuff settles out. But then there's even weirder stuff like the leap motion deal, you know, where it's like, you know, you like what, 5-finger punch your monitor and then whatever opens the dialog box or something. I don't know. It's weird.
But that'll map to click, won't it?
Yeah, I guess. Or like a Hadouken does whatever. Like, that's
going to be
a
native. Hadouken's going to be a native DOM event pretty soon.
Yeah.
Hadouken!
Window on Hadouken. Make this happen, internet.
Chase Woodford has an audio questions about hackathons. Can you cue that guy up?
Yeah, I'm going to cue it up here.
Hey, guys. I got a question for Pam about hackathons. What should someone who's never been to one expect? Like, if I'm not a rock star programmer in any one language in particular, am I still able to participate and contribute to these type of events? I've been following Pam, and what she's done in Philly has been really awesome. Really liked what she did at the Random Hacks of Kindness last year and the app that they put out, Ad Hoc. That was really great. And I thought it was really cool, but I'm just not sure if those type of events are something that I would really be able to contribute in. Thanks.
Okay, Pam, hackathons. What could Chase expect if you were to jump in?
So definitely, there's kind of hackathons kind of follow a standard pattern. And first, like, I would want to say that Chase, like, no matter what language you're good at, hackathons are also a great excuse to go and work on something that you've wanted to learn. Because that's one of the things about learning a new language or a new process is that if you don't have a project to work on, you can do all the tutorials, you do whatever, but it just doesn't stick. So actually, when I worked on that Ad Hoc project, that was my first time working on a real Android project. I'd done just like tutorials and had a friend of mine show me how to do Hello World in Android. And then I was at the hackathon writing an Android application. And so that's like a pretty good thing that draws technology people. But that said, like, hackathons are generally, they're good for anyone. And one of the things that's especially in hackathons, I'd love to see more people who aren't programmers or developers come, and especially you need more visual designers. You need people to just, like, run the ship. So you need project manager type people who want to be able to, you know, say that they helped a project, you know, get on its feet.
You might know zero languages, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, English, but...
right.
Or depending on what your hackathon is, whatever the actual spoken languages. But yeah, like, because you need people, if you're going to, say you're going to build something for the homeless coalition, and you got a bunch of developers who are like, oh, that's such a great idea. You need some way to be like, hey guys, maybe we should call the homeless coalition and see if they want something like this and if this fits their needs and that kind of thing. And you don't need to know how to write a line of code to do that. The other thing is there's a couple strategies for hackathons. You kind of decide going in, you should kind of know if you want to win or not, like blatantly. to put it very bluntly, like if you want to win, like you need to have a lot more, you need to have your stuff together. Usually you should already be on a team. You should know what problem you're probably going to work on. You don't, like you haven't written any line of code because that would be violating the rules. But like Angel Hack is a big competitive hackathon coming up. And so if you want to win, like you should be on a team. But if you're just in it for fun or to learn something cool, to meet some cool people, like you really can't do it wrong. If there's a mixer beforehand, you generally go to the mixer because then you can ask people about their problems. And especially if you are a developer, you can help people with bad problems, kind of form their question. So like if they're like, I want to solve homeless, and you're like, that's not a software problem. Then you can help them kind of define and scope it down to something that can be done in a hackathon. And that's, you can be really, really helpful to people. But yeah, there's lots of places to get involved in hackathons. They're a lot of fun, and I always encourage them to get involved. I think once you go to one, you're generally going to be a little, at least I'm a little addicted, and there's a lot of fun. You see your friends who go to them. You meet tons of new people every time. So highly recommended.
Awesome. Chase, you should go.
Yep. Basically, summary.
Nice.
Yeah, I think don't let like fear of not being useful enough stop you, because I mean, anyone's useful when it comes to like helping out your government or any sort of civic hackathon kind of thing.
I went to one in New Orleans. It was one. It wasn't I don't even know if it had a name, but it was a day after bar camp. Let's build something thing, and it was literally half the people were language free other than English, and they did tons of work in kind of just keeping everybody on track and planning the project, and naming it, and social media stuff, and you know.
Because I know if I was in that position, I would just be like, somebody just tell me what to do, because I would be in like execution mode
from
a developer standpoint. Like,
because you're most useful that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, anyhow.
Let me do a quick sponsor quick. We have the Cotton Bureau. I said at the top of the show, cotton and then BUREAU.com, cottonbureau.com. So it's from the guys from United Pixel Workers, who maybe you've heard of because I bet Pam knows because I think they're Philly. Or maybe Pittsburgh, but I think Pitt. Philly, aren't they?
Pitt,
sorry. Anyway, yeah. Pennsylvania.
Sorry, they're very far apart.
Yeah, it's a long state. Anyway, sorry. And I knew that too, because I was talking to Nathan from there at this last conference I was at, and they call it like the Rust Belt, and they kind of pseudo think of themselves as Midwest. And anyway, the Cotton Bureau is from those guys, but it's not necessarily 100% related. The deal is, if you have an idea for a t-shirt, which everybody does, right? But making t-shirts is, it's hard to make money on, and it sucks to ship, and it sucks to figure out an online store, and what about, you know, returns, and blah, blah, blah. There's just a million things you have to think about. Chances are, you're not going to do well selling t-shirts. Cotton Bureau handles all of that stuff, and all the only thing that you have to do is come up with the design. So you have this awesome t-shirt idea, and you give it to them, and they'll put it up on like a beautiful looking site, and you know they're going to do well at this because United Pixel Workers site is like a beautiful looking site. And if 25 people buy it, you know, they look at your shirt and it's for sale and it's $25, or I don't even know what the price is. But if they sell 25 of them, then they'll print it out and ship it. If you sell 1,000 of them, they'll print it out and ship it. If they sell 20, then it just it's a wash. Everybody gets their money back and it doesn't get printed or whatever. So it's just kind of,
I think that's like the break even price. Like
probably, yeah.
You need 25 or more to start making money or something.
Yeah. So it's just neat, and you just, if you're a good designer or whatever, you have a good idea for a shirt, make it, send it to them. It takes 2 seconds, and maybe you'll get on it. And it's neat. I think the range of shirts they're gonna get are gonna be wider. And I don't think it has to be pseudo tech related like Pixel Workers are.
Yeah, I don't think so. It can be any shirt. So they're trying to take the hassle out of like t-shirts, because they posted on their blog over at Full Stop. I can maybe dig up a link, but just talking about everything that goes into like producing shirts, because they've got experience in this, and like it's a hassle. It's complete hassle every step of the way. And then like you've got to get the right kind of t-shirt, the right kind of ink, the right kind of printer, the right kind of, you know.
Right. So they and that's easy to screw up too. You can get those things and then do a bad job. Mm-hmm. They're also not going to do that. Oh, I just think it's awesome and a good idea, and you should send in your design. So at this second, they're at the point where they're just, go there and put in your email address and you'll get notified when this is ready to go. And you can be submitting designs right now. And very soon will be the real deal, where they start accepting ones and whatever. And, you know, and if you have a bad design, they're just going to tell you. So it is kind of up to their discretion. They're not, there's going to be no, you know, for lack of a better word, crap on here.
Mm-hmm.
Cotton Bureau, check it out. Thanks for sponsoring, guys. Cottonbureau.com.
Ernesto Chavez wrote in, said, client-side templating versus server-side templating. Use cases for when to use one over the other, if possible. Pam, do you do client-side templating?
Yeah, we do. We do some.
Do you have any input here?
Yeah, I actually do, because I think it's a really good question, actually, because at least I feel like when we get, I love client-side frameworks and that kind of stuff, and there's so much cool stuff happening in JavaScript, and like that's like the only way to put it. It's just cool stuff. Like I love Angular, I love all the backbone stuff, I love, you know. I kind of like Ember. I'm still waffling. But the thing about client-side templating versus server-side is it just comes down to whether it's a good idea.
Well, maybe explain what the difference is and some examples of each or whatever. And then
sure. Angular is fairly new. It's adopted at Google, is where the home base of the developers are. And that's an MVStar kind of framework where you bring actually your controllers and some of the things into your view on the client side, which is very non-traditional, but I really like it for a client-side framework because client-side is different than server-side. So a simple model view controller setup is meant for generally the server side, and so I think it makes sense that we might do something different on client-side, and we just kind of did the same pattern on client-side as server-side because that's what we wanted to do. But I really like that. So in Angular, if you go and do the, you know, you can see it just from like even the tutorial, they tell you stuff about like, oh, here's a block and assign a controller to this block. And then it breaks things out into nice little concrete portions, which I like that kind of stuff because it makes things very maintainable, in my opinion. So you just keep from having the, anything that keeps us moving in the direction of not having the giant like site.js file that runs everything, I'm generally in favor of. And so I really like the way they do patterns. As for Ember.js, that's a framework that is written by Yuta Katz, is one of the writers of it. And then there's lots of other maintainers and contributors. It's basically Rails for JavaScript. So In the Rails world, people really like it because if you're used to those patterns, pretty much just start writing Rails, but you're writing it in JavaScript. And so Rails developers really like that. It's a bit too heavy for my taste. It's a lot bigger than some other frameworks. And so it's, you know, it depends on if you really need everything in Ember, which is the same thing about Rails. Like, you don't need Rails to solve every problem. Sometimes you just want to write, you know, a simple little app in Sinatra or something.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so those are some of the frameworks. But back to the question is about server-side versus client-side templating. And yeah, the thing about that is generally if you need some computing power, it seems really silly to me to put that on the client side, which is why I do like working in Python a lot and things like that. It's because if I want to do some serious, like, you know, cranking through my database and things like that, I'm going to do that on the server side because, you know, makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so that's generally the thing, is I think we do a lot on the client side now because it's very interesting. But I think we probably could do more on the server side, especially if you're talking about data. Client side is great for, say, like, we have a problem with one of our sites that we need to fix is in the bug queue. But we're doing, it's one of those things where we're doing something very silly on the server side that we should just do on the client side because it's cheap. So like if it's cheap, you should just do it on the client side so that you get your page to load faster. So we're doing something like we're parsing RSS feeds. Like that's something that's just like silly to do on the server side because RSS feeds are cheap and they're really easy to interact with in JavaScript. So you might as well just do on the client side, get your page to load faster, have your little spinny doohickey going while you wait for your callbacks to come back. And then, you know, your page is populated. That's something where, like, I think client-side makes, like, tons and tons of sense, is making your page fast, and you didn't need the server power to get the data.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's say you had, like, a comment form, and there's, like, three fields in a text area, and you, like, click submit comment. Like, what might happen in, like, old school days is that sends that data to the server, and the server, like, chews it up, and maybe even the page refreshes, and then the comment is there. But these days, it might be kind of cool to, like, have a client-side template that, like, defines what a comment looks like, and you hit submit, and the template, like, puts the new comment there, and it just, like, sends that data off the server, which saves the comment. Would that be, like, a use case for client-side templating?
Yeah, I'd say
I just made that up.
I mean, no, because, I mean, that's an example of cheap data. Like, a comment is what? Like, text?
You already have the data. You don't even have to ask for it. You know?
Yeah, exactly. It's cheap, and you're sending it up to the server, so you can, you know, load it on the page. Or, you know, you send your request, and when you have success, you let them know you had success and that kind of stuff. And, yeah, it's very easy to have a client-side template that's just your JavaScript. You're just like, well, use this template and make me a new comment. And, yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I kind of wish that, like, is there a way, this isn't my specialty necessarily, but that you could define a template that's kind of both. I think sometimes I do that in Rails where there's like a little partial and it might define what a comment looks like and I can Ajax for that partial and like the route and controller kind of like fills in the stuff that it needs. So I can use it in Rails, but I can also Ajax for it if I want it. So it's kind of both.
Yeah, I mean, I remember doing that when I was working in Rails. We would have, you know, little mustache templates. Like, that was the templating language that we favored then, which is, you know, fairly logicless templating. And so, yeah, and we would have the Rails view and we would have, you know, mustache views in there, and then you would go grab it with your JavaScript. So that's one way to do it too, for sure, especially if your JavaScript, you know, if you're doing mostly a server-side application and you, you know, if your JavaScript's a little messy or something, and you don't have it all separated out into nice, fun controllers and partials and things, and you just kind of have functionality for an area, that's where we were kind of using pretty much exact same solution, where you didn't have to have a controller for that area, because you basically, at that point, you're doubling what you're doing on the server side. So you would just say, like, load this JavaScript on this page, and if we have this area, then this is the interaction we're going to define for it.
Yeah. Perfect.
Cool. Yeah, I think the word logicless is where I latch onto. It's like if you're most client-side templates try to be logicless. Like, you get a for loop, a if statement, and that's it. So,
and that's Yeah, a lot of them don't have that.
So that's where I kind of draw the line is, like, you know, if I'm trying to do a bunch of stuff, I should just do it on the server and use a bunch of different partials or something like that and crunch that in. And then, yeah, I also think a lot about fallbacks, but those aren't always necessary, but yeah, you want the server side fallback if something goes wrong, like that common example, like if the JavaScript, you wrote some bad JavaScript and the JavaScript quit working, like the comment form would still work. It would post to the server and it would come back.
Yeah, it should still submit a form. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
But the Ajax-y version is just like, whatever. It's just like on success, like you said, Pam, just on success, print out a comment. Bingo. So that would be that's where I put the line, I think. Done. Okay. Cool. Hey, good job, team. All right.
Brent Lagerman asks about resets versus normalize. And we haven't talked about that in a while.
All right, here we go. It's an audio question, our favorite kind of question here at the Shop Talk Show.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Dave. This is Brent from Brooklyn. My company is Condensed.io. The question I have is about normalize.css versus reset.css. I know there's been a lot of discussion about this in the past, and you guys made some really great, arguments for why to use it, and I understand them, and I've just been trying to get on board with it and having a hard time. I've had issues where, like, just one that came up recently was I had a hard time with a space at the top of my web page where there was just this gap there, and it took a long time to figure it out, and it just came back to, oh, there's this bit in normalize that normally would be taken out by a reset, but it's there. And that's just one concrete example, but other things have come up too, where you're just like in there coding and you don't want to think about what the defaults are for browser elements. So I guess, for me, and maybe it's just me, it's really been great to have everything zeroed out and then just add things on, like say you want to add on a bunch of margin or padding for headings. It seems like that would be something that you would want to target the content area for instance. Whereas if it was every heading on the whole website, you're just going to run into a bunch of issues. So I'm wondering if other developers have run into this type of problem, and, or if it's maybe just me, maybe I can't figure it out. I don't know.
I'm going to fade him out there.
Yeah. I have that problem too, where you restate the same thing 50 times. Not 50. I didn't mean to be that, but you know, it's cool. So Pam, do you use / heard of / like dislike normalize?
I mean, I've heard of it. I just checked it out again, and it doesn't look like it's changed since I last checked it out. I think the biggest thing about normalize to remember is that, I mean, I think of it as a framework. It gives you some sort of bootstrapped thing, at least for CSS, like what we define frameworks as CSS. But like, it gives you some sort of base to work off of, just like Twitter Bootstrap, just like base.css, which is another one that I've been checking out recently, just like, you know, Zen's foundation. It's another framework. So if you're like, it's when he talked about, I forget what he said his name was,
Let's get it right. Brent.
Brent. So when Brent's having that problem with the top of the page, I mean, that sounds exactly to me like when people are like, what the heck is Bootstrap doing here? Oh, okay, Bootstrap does this thing that way. I think that's the thing. That's why I shy away from normalize. You know what I really love to see? I'd love to see normalize SAS, like where it's just like setting up a whole bunch of variables how you want, and then you generate your normalize through those SAS variables.
You might like an Inuit for that, then. That CSS wizardry framework is like that. It's like a sassy...
Is it sassy?
Variable-y. Yeah, and it has, like, config stuff.
Excellent. Yeah, I definitely prefer config-friendly stuff. I mean, that's I like Foundation, because it's config-friendly in the same way.
I think you're 100% right, but also, like... That argument could also be slightly changed to be for normalized. Just quick, I think it's this framework, but just like with Bootstrap, it's like, Bootstrap is always meant to be customized. You know, go in there and change how it worked. Using normalized requires a different mental thinking a little bit. Don't just put normalize in your page and then just leave it there and then go write your CSS, and if there's a little space above the page or whatever, you're like, oh, normalize, and shake your fist. Go fix it in normalize. That's what it's for. So it's supposed to be like, I don't know, like anything that's in normalize.
So you're saying that don't, like, because I usually think of when I download a vendor script or a vendor library that I don't touch it, and then I modify other stuff. You're saying that people should feel free to go in and modify.
It requires a mental shift. Yeah. That's what you're supposed to do. It requires a different approach to how you do things. So anything that's in normalize now needs to be there because there's problems cross-browser with what that thing is. So it needs to be there to set it. So one of those things can be something like margin or padding. So normalize has margin and padding set on these things because it's a cross-browser problem. But if you set it to something different, if you're like, oh, I want my H1s to have margin bottom 1M, you're still fixing that cross-browsing problem because you're being explicit about it. So it's better than a reset, in my opinion, because you're fixing all the cross-browser problems and being specific about what you want to be, whereas a reset just wipes it all out. So you end up writing it twice. You know, you reset the margin on the H1, and then later on you go set it. In normalize, you're still getting the cross-browser benefit, and you're customizing what you want your defaults to be. I just think it's more efficient. Anyway, other thoughts?
You had feelings.
Good feelings, Chris. I'm probably the same. I don't use normalize. I tried to get it, but then I don't know. I see the buttons and then I'm angry. And then so I just go back to writing it. But I think you're right. Like the reset is pretty aggressive, you know, and it's not like super future scalable or whatever. As we keep adding elements to the HTML5, are you going through your reset and you're resetting all those elements? Probably not. So normalize.
I'm thinking about doing one. I have the itch. The Chris Coyer reset. It's coming.
It's coming.
Body overflow X hidden. Very, very opinionated.
Yeah. That's good. That's good. You should just do overflow Y hidden too. Just for one page apps.
Nobody will be mad about that. There'll be no trouble.
Position fixed.
I understand. So I understand both sides of this. It is, you know, we had three different opinions there, which makes this a good radio program.
I think I would benefit from normalize if I used it. Like if you sat down and you're like four, you know, 2 days of just like, cool, I'm doing this with normalize, hell or high water, I think you'd get it and you'd probably just fall back in love.
You know what you should not do? Go download it and put it in your existing project. Like, no, don't do that.
Yeah. Don't. It's something different. I wouldn't expect it to be similar to a reset, you know? Just, there you go. That's my words of wisdom.
Nicholas Gallagher worked on it, and he has a, just go look at a recent tweet. He's got a thing like, help the web stop using normalize, which is like, what? When you read it? But then he's got a point. It's like, it was about like, anything that's in normalize is basically like a bug. You can look at it as a big bug list. And anyway.
What if somebody took normalize and split it up into like SAS partials, like type and forms or something like that? Yeah. Then people would be like, this is the best thing ever.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Then you have Inuit.
Yeah, that's called Inuit. Perfect. All right, next question comes from Pat McKenna. Let me see if I have this on my...
I think we may have talked about this before, but it's classic, so...
Okay, here we go.
G'day, guys. Pat from Melbourne, Australia here. I know it's standard practice to load common scripts like jQuery from an external site like jQuery CDN or Google CDN. But this makes me feel really weird. Like, say, if I load up jQuery from the jQuery CDN and the CDN goes down, then everything on my site that uses jQuery suddenly doesn't work anymore. So shouldn't I just host all my own assets on my own site? Then the only server I have to depend on is my own. And at least if that goes down, then the users just don't get access to the site, as opposed to getting access to a janky, half-broken site. Or are these big CDNs just so good that they never have any downtime and I just shouldn't worry about it? Keen to hear your thoughts. Thanks, guys.
I'd like to point out that audio file was in Pat's directory at /pants.
Perfect. Okay, Pat is having problems with his jQuery on a CDN.
Oh, that was so bad.
What do you think there, Brett?
Oh, Pim? Pim, you got an opinion?
Yeah, I think it's something that we've already kind of figured out. When I generally see these, like, find snippets when I'm like, oh yeah, I need to shove it in. Actually, yeah, and someone just put it into the chat. You do async. You go and try and get, you put your link to your external, and then if you're, then underneath you have your async that's, if you have jQuery, then whatever, but if you don't, then add your script tag that accesses your server's version. I mean, it's a fallback, so, I mean,
yeah, and it's
fine.
Two lines, though, it's really easy.
Yeah. Yep. So I think that's a pretty common answer to Pat's question, I think.
Yeah, just link it up from the CDN because there's benefits to doing that. Asterisk, then put the callback after that. Asterisk is that it's still pretty proven that you should probably be bundling jQuery with the rest of your assets. Like, it's that's going to have the biggest benefit if you know, is like a build script where jQuery is just one of the many other dependencies that your site has. Like splitting off jQuery to load it from your CDN just for that one dependency on like most apps in the world is weird. And you're going to get the most benefit from like bundling it with the rest of your scripts.
Yeah. I think if you like ran a network, like some sort of like The Verge or something like that, you might want to split jQuery apart from your bundled right. assets.
Or even CSS tricks. Cause I just have, yeah. I have jQuery and I have like, you know, site.js that it's not even embarrassing really. It's just not that JavaScript heavy of a site really. So there's really just a little bit of JavaScript in jQuery just because I like jQuery and it makes it easier to write for me. And I don't care. You know, that's yeah. a good use case for it. But any like app level stuff, I mean, jQuery is just one of the dependencies probably.
I'm actually leaning towards bundling it now, especially after that Alex Sexton episode of Shop Talk. That was some synergy pitching right there. He kind of just broke that down and for me, I think I'm just going to try and save the HTTP request because I'm interested in how that'll work for my site. So think about that, I guess. Hopefully that helps you, Pat. Pit.
Yeah. The simple right. answer, though, is just what Pam said. The fallback is WikiEasy.
Cool.
Let me do a quick sponsor here. We have Environments for Humans, which you all know because they've sponsored the show forever. They do online conferences. They do like mostly those. A big one that listeners of this show would enjoy. Have you ever seen when Audible sponsors other podcasts? They're like, listeners of this podcast might enjoy, like, you know, fart jokes by Dave Rupert or whatever. And they suggest a conference that listeners of Shop Talk might enjoy is the CSS Summit, literally CSSSummit.com. And it will redirect you to the Environments Humans site. For this is the fifth annual, it's been going forever, 3-day online live CSS conference. It is July 23rd through 25th. So you have a little bit of time to buy your tickets and stretch your arms or whatever you need to do to get ready for this thing. But it's awesome. It's like the definitive all CSS online conference that there is. I've done it a couple times. It's way awesome. What else can we say about these online conferences? I think the back and forth chat that happens during them is really good because, you know, in-person conferences don't even have that really. Like if everybody at the conference is always in the same chat room, you get like really good conversation, which is cool.
One thing that's cool is you can watch whenever you want. Like you get
access record to
a recording. So it's like
right.
if whatever you're at the doctor the first morning and you miss Estelle a while, you know, talk about selectors, you can like catch up on that either that night or 10 months later. So I've actually I've been, you know, we speak at these occasionally, Chris, but I've actually gone back and listened to people because usually like it's like during my work day and it's like I can't leave or something. So I have to leave to go do work, but you can like catch up. So that's pretty cool. It's kind of like super high quality screencasts as well. So,
Rachel Andrew talking about CSS grids. Tim Brown from Typekit talking about web typography. Chris Mills from Opera talking about getting rid of images with CSS. Rachel Neighbors, who we've had on the show, talking about making music videos with CSS3 and HTML5. Ex Shop Talk alum. Bell Head Infographics. I mean, there's just the lit on and on and on. Just everybody's at this thing. It's going to be awesome. Okay. What do we got? Dimitri Ganoff asks, I am trying to put together a standard front-end boilerplate framework, you know, HTML, CSS, JavaScript, for my team to use for all of our web projects going forward. I really like what a lot of Twitter Bootstrap has to offer, but I might want to swap out some pieces for other frameworks. Would you suggest mixing and matching parts of frameworks such as Twitter Bootstrap, Foundation, etc.? Like, is that okay? He's asking it. P.S. My team would prefer to use jQuery and SCSS. So that's a part of it right there, is that if those are your requirements, then, well, Bootstrap's in less. So you could find a fork, I guess, or...
Yeah, someone's made that conversion.
Sure.
So, I mean, it was interesting. It kind of goes back, actually, to what we were talking about with normalize, where it's like, I generally... don't know, this is like my old school thing of don't touch core from that I learned like when I first got into web development. I mean, like there aren't rules about, you know, oh my God, if you mix things, like some kittens are going to die. But at the same time, like there's a reason why you don't touch core, and that's because if there's an upgrade that you want, you can't upgrade because you touched core. So that's why I generally lean toward the don't touch core end of things. And if you're making a framework, if your goal is to make a framework that your entire team is going to use, why not make a framework? You know, I mean, if there's pieces from other things, like why not write custom stuff that's unique to your team? I think that's where I'm kind of getting stuck, is that kind of the question was, oh, I'm going to make this framework, but then like as Dmitry, as you went on, you said, oh, but I'm going to take all these pieces together. And so, I don't know. I lean towards kind of, if you're going to like build it off of something, going with one thing and sticking with it, and then building your custom stuff of exactly what you want, instead of trying to, you know, put all the circles and squares all together. I lean more towards that, that if you're going to, especially if you're going to build something that you want to use on a bunch of different projects, you start building custom stuff.
DIY it, dude.
Yeah. And that, yeah, cause I really love talking about frameworks. It's like one of the questions that's interesting me right now, especially since I recently joined a newsroom, is that we do end up having to lean on frameworks because we don't write custom stuff all the time, because it's just, even though we'd get more time than a normal newsroom, we, you know, we'll still be cranking data up until, you know, close to launch time. And then, you know, we had started with a framework for our front end, and then we, you know, we keep going with it just because we can build a couple components that are custom that we might then carry on to a next project. So building like a component at a time on each project is another approach that I really like. So you don't have to build all the custom at once because you don't know what every project wants. And I know people at agencies who love SaaS who do it. And they just like build these components, and they're like, oh, I had to write this component for this project. And then they see another project that wants a similar component, and oh, great, because they already wrote it. And since Dmitry's already using SCSS, I think it just makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah,
it makes me feel weird, Frankenstein-y, to think that you're going to go grab 50% of Bootstrap and 50% of Foundation and squish them together. I can't imagine that going well.
Yeah, I was, yeah, same. Like, you're going to spend all your time debugging the, like, Frankenstrap framework, you know, the Franken framework. So, like,
Frank Found Strap.
So you're going to spend all your time, like, figuring out the inconsistencies. It would have been faster to just write your own. I would harvest HTML and stuff like that, but how they sit in the grid and stuff like that is probably different too. So I don't know. Yeah, I would harvest components you like, and maybe try to. The HTML should work in any framework unless it's grid sensitive. But yeah, the CSS is going to be tough because Bootstrap's written in less. Foundation, I don't even know. So
oh, Foundation SaaS.
It's SaaS.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Which I bet is a reason why it's kind of popular.
Yeah. Because
mm-hmm. It's like it's the one that you use if you like SaaS.
Yeah. And it's also not it's not the one that every website on the internet looks like it was made with.
Right.
Oh.
I hear that a lot. And is that, I want to start, there should be, is there a gallery or something that, I feel like I don't actually see it all that much. Is it mostly common on like GitHub projects or?
Yeah, I mean like anything where someone's like, look, I made this JavaScript library. Go to the website for my JavaScript library. It's going to be Bootstrap. Like mm-hmm. anytime someone's doing like a little one-off thing, it's always a Bootstrap thing. And anytime I see like a startup's, you know, like alpha or beta, you know, like initial beta, first iteration, I generally see it in Bootstrap. Which generally means they need to hire a designer. But no.
All right. Do we have a quick one we can do before we, or do you?
Yeah. Let's see. Or Pam, are you good on time?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. Here we go. Let's I'm going to do this audio question.
The rich one. Yeah, this sounds
rich
good.
Finale here. Got it. Okay.
Hi, Chris and Dave. My name is Rich from Piscataway, New Jersey. I'm a big fan of the show, even bought a t-shirt. I'm a front-end web developer and recently redesigned the front end of a large web application. It no longer uses frames and tables. We substituted that with newer best practices, put a fresh coat of paint on it as well, new logo, color scheme, and all that stuff. Now, the problem we're having is when a user first visits the website, they get a version that is half frames and tables and half the new version. So it looks all messed up. All they have to do is refresh their browser or, you know, we tell them to hit F5 and that repaints it correctly and it looks great. This is a slight problem because our audience is people who are not very tech savvy and it just looks ugly. So my question is this a common site? Is this common in a site redesign? And is there any way to avoid something like this? Thanks again, guys. You guys do a great job.
So got an old site that's like frames and tables and a new site, and now people are getting kind of a half and half version.
Yeah, which seems weird because it seems more likely that the CSS is cached and like, you know, or something. But is this, wouldn't the document have to be cached for this to be a problem?
Yeah, I don't know. That's like, it just sounds weird. I think like the cheater way, which I have totally done this before to force cache expiration, is I've just renamed the CSS file. And then it's a new file. And so like, no matter how untechnical your people are, like when they get the request, it'll be like, you know, oh, well, this is a CSS file we haven't seen before. And even just like even adding a version string. Number, you know, adding a version number to it is just a way to do that. And that's what a lot of people do for cache expiry. I don't know. This is definitely a weird problem.
I still do that on CSS tricks sometimes because I don't really have a build process. So I'm just like, question mark V equals 1.6.
Right.
Yeah. That used to not work, but it works fine now in browsers. But that's CSS, and it seems like if you're getting half tables and stuff, that's like that's document.
That's the document. Yeah.
So maybe there was, you can serve a cache document, you know, if you say, if you tell, you know, have your Apache or whatever serve a header of to tell it to cache.
Yeah, and that might be something to make sure that
you're not doing well,
he's talking to the backend developers, because if he helped roll out this redesign, maybe the backend developers didn't think, oh, well, we need to make sure we're expiring all our caches. So that's something. It does sound like that it might be a more on their end that it's not his fault. Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
Yeah. It is common though, and I feel your pain, Mr. Rich. I've seen that type of thing before, but yeah, like we said, it's usually assets that are the problem. So try maybe some of that stuff gets loaded in with JavaScript, or maybe it's a JavaScript problem. Do the same thing Pam suggested there. Bust the cache on your JavaScript as well.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, I guess I'm not sure.
Yeah, sounds like cache. I mean, you could go into your htaccess and like just redirect.
Set expires zero.
Yeah, expires zero for like a month or something like that, and you're going to have poor performance for a month, but better that than and get all your users.
Yeah, the broken site thing is certainly a problem.
Yeah.
I wonder if window.location equals window.location, or force a refresh is what I'm trying to say. Does that bust cache?
Like a meta location kind of thing,
except for the fact that would be, you know, circular
infinite loop.
Yeah.
All right, you'd have to set a cookie, but then the cookie isn't reliable.
Yeah.
Oh, except for the fact that you'd just destroy your website. Other than that problem.
Yeah. You could do meta refresh --refresh equals 2 or whatever. So like forward it to with a param,
with a queer string.
If the param is there, then
yeah, there you go. Dave, wow. So smart. Oh, that's a good way to go out. Really bad suggestion.
Really brain bender. Well, cool. Pam, thanks so much for coming on the show. For people who
aren't
already following you, how can people follow you, get in touch with you, download your stuff, give you money?
Oh, I am on the Twitters at Pamasaur, like a dinosaur, Pamasaur. Website, thewebofwar.com, and I'm on GitHub at pselle, selle.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day and coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening, coming out in the chat room, fact-checking us. We really appreciate that. And, we'll be here next week, I think. And follow us on Twitter, at Shop Talk Show. Rate us up in iTunes. 5 stars. It's just that easy. And, Chris, do you have anything else?
I'm still looking to sell that first woman's tea. So this is a big opportunity for our female Shop Talk Show listeners here to prove that was a good idea buying those shirts. ShopTalkShow.com.